Good morning. May it please the court. I am Hassan Zavari, and I am here on behalf of plaintiffs Jared Beck, Aaron Galloway, and Kirthi Reddy, who are the appellants and appellees in this case. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Your Honor, for purposes of this appeal, the most important issues in this case are the issues that the district court failed to consider at all. First, the issue of whether or not a deception occurred. Whether or not the plaintiffs were actually a victim, were actually victims of deception.
What's your best evidence of any deception?
Well, let me address the question of deception first, and then intent separately, because I think that those are two separate issues. But
no, I just asked about deception.
Okay.
You said there was deception, the district court didn't look at it.
All of the plaintiffs testified that they went to TES's, Test Master Educational Services, website.
And what's false in the website?
If you look at JA 234 to 235, which is the new website of TES that came up just in 2003, and you compare that to the website at JA 233, which is the website of...
I'm sorry, what are we comparing? We're comparing...
JA 235.
Yeah.
To JA 233. JA 233 is the website of a company that's been operating out of California since 1991 and providing LSAT preparation services.
It's TES that we're interested in, right?
It is, Your Honor, and JA 235 is the TES website.
Right.
And the reason it's deceptive, Your Honor, is because it was not until this point, in 2003, that they changed their website to mimic the website.
Why don't we look at the actual website to see whether it's deceptive?
That's what I'm pointing to, Your Honor. The actual.
I'm sorry, but you want to do a later website than the one.
No, this was in 2003 when this occurred,
okay.
Your Honor.
All right.
What I'm saying is that prior to 2003, Your Honor, TES had never offered LSAT courses anywhere. They'd been teaching SAT classes and engineering classes only in the state of Texas. In 2003, they put up the website that's at JA 235 that has the map of the United States and purports to have schedules and locations of LSAT classes all across the country, when in fact they had never offered LSAT classes.
But as I understand it, they were ready to offer them. Right, if enough people signed up.
Well, that's the first part of the deception, Your Honor. And the second part of the
deception... What's the first part of the deception?
Is the website indicating that they were actually conducting web classes at all of these locations,
when in fact
they were
not. Is that what that suggests to you? I mean, it says to find a course in your state, click either on the map or on a link below. So if I click on Nevada, what am I going to get?
It has a schedule of a course that was never offered.
I see.
And what happened is students repeatedly called and tried to schedule courses. They would sign people up for these courses, and then at the very last minute, as with plaintiff Aaron Galloway, they said, sorry, we don't have a course there. One consumer actually flew. Her course was canceled. She was supposed to take
She's
a course in Florida.
Right.
She's not, but her declaration is before the court here.
Yeah, but we're interested in misrepresentations to the plaintiffs, right?
Well, indeed we are, Your Honor, but the misrepresentations to other defendants also go to the question of the deception. I'm sorry, to other students goes to the question of the deception and to the intent of TES.
Well, I go to intent, but I'm not sure how it goes to the deception of these three plaintiffs.
Because they show that it was reasonable for students looking at this to believe that this company was not what it purported to be. And if I may, the second aspect of the deception occurred when the people called in and spoke to the representations. And with respect to the plaintiffs here in this particular case, they made affirmative misrepresentations.
Step back up. two of the plaintiffs signed up before any conversation at all, right? It's entirely on the basis of the website.
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. That's not correct, no. Plaintiffs Beck and Reddy both called in beforehand, and plaintiff Galloway called in, registered, and then after she had registered, they changed the location.
Right.
Then she had a conversation.
Galloway. Beck, what's the, he calls for?
JA-191 is his declaration, Your Honor. And with respect to Mr. Galloway, Mr. Beck, he testified that he called the toll-free number and that he got a call before the course was supposed to begin, and that he told the person answering the phone that he had taken the heard about the course from others who had taken it in D.C. Keerthy Reddy actually testified, Your Honor.
Actually, I mean, I'm just looking at 191. We have a going to the website, and then we have a telephone call. Does he say when he signed up?
I don't believe it's explicitly in here as far as, well, it says she told me she had all my information since she had downloaded the registration form from the fax and faxed my registration to them at an earlier date.
Then, sounds as if he did register on the web.
Well, what he did was he registered and then faxed in the information, and then he called and spoke to her at the same time, or subsequent to that.
Subsequent, okay.
Yes, Your Honor. The second part of the deception occurred during those phone calls, Your Honor. With respect to Ms. Reddy, they actually told her affirmatively that they had held courses in Cincinnati when they had not. They told her that they had held courses in D.C. when they had not. And the other plaintiffs made it clear that they were taking the course based on its excellent reputation in D.C., where the course had been offered for several years, and none of the representatives told the plaintiffs that they had not.
Who are these representatives?
They're telephone operators, and I will note, Your Honor, that we were, TES refused to give us the identities of these telephone operators in discovery, so we're unable to depose them.
But you didn't make any complaint about discovery in your initial brief, your opening brief, right?
No, Your Honor, because the issue of intent was not raised in the...
it was obviously an issue that was potential out there.
The district court ruled that the intent was not an issue and refused to address...
That didn't prevent it from being an issue here.
I beg your pardon?
That did not prevent it from being an issue here.
Well... But it was not an issue that we were raising, Your Honor. It was an issue that was raised and we addressed in our reply brief. And we addressed the issue of intent in our reply brief and addressed the fact that we were unable to get this discovery. And we had filed a 56F motion, and Judge Robertson ruled that the 56F motion was irrelevant because he was not going to address the issues of intent, and explicitly stated that our motion, our 56F motion, did go to the questions of intent. I'm running out of time, and I wanted to save some time for rebuttal, but I just want to address the issue of damages and standing, which I think are the issues that the court improperly ruled on in this case. First, with respect to the issue of damages, the court completely failed to address any of our other claims of damages, focusing only on the question of lost opportunity damages. Didn't look at the statutory damages, didn't look at the out-of-pocket damages.
Would a federal court have jurisdiction?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Why?
Under Shaw versus Marriott, when you have a violation of the CPPA, that confers standing if you are protected by the statute. And all of these plaintiffs were consumers.
I'm sorry, what's the, what court decided Shaw?
D.C. Circuit, Your Honor, 2010. And the quote is, the deprivation of such a statutory right may constitute injury in fact, sufficient to establish standing, even though the plaintiff would have suffered no judicially cognizable injury in the absence of the statute. And so even if accepting Judge Robertson's determination that there were no damages as true, because these plaintiffs were all victims of deceptive acts, then they were in fact, they did in fact have standing. They're entitled to statutory damages, and the law is clear that by virtue of those statutory injury, you have a protectable right to not have your statutory rights violated, that you do indeed have standing. That is an injury in fact. And in addition, the simple damages relating to their out-of-pocket damages also provide an injury in fact. The evidence here is undisputed that the courses that they wanted to take was superior, 80 hours versus 30 hours. Perfect people.
You might say that difference makes your adversary's course superior. Law students are interested in the results, not in how much time it takes.
Your Honor, there was no evidence presented by the defendants countering or objecting to.
You presented no evidence at all that the course offered by your client was in any way better in terms of its effects than the course offered by TES, right? That's correct, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, if you're saying with respect to
the
effects, you're talking about the LSAT scores, then that's not something that we are able to prove.
Or really any other measure in terms of consumer preference.
I disagree with that completely, Your Honor. You look at the declarations of the dozens of students who said it was awful and said it was atrocious. The instructors had no training.
Pretty much any test prep.
Your Honor, these students all testify that for the most important test of their life, including lawyers, parents of these students who were lawyers, testified that this was a fraud on their children, and that these people all believed that they were getting one thing, and they ended up getting photocopied
papers.
How would
the parents know that it was a fraud?
I'm sorry?
How would the parents know it was a fraud on their children?
Because the parents paid for the class and called Michael Jacobs, called for a student in this very same class, Lauren Jacobs, a lawyer from New York, called to enroll his daughter, and he submitted a declaration saying that it was clear to him that they knew that he was looking for the other company and that they did not tell him that, and that he believed that was a fraud.
Fraud being that it wasn't what they purchased. I thought you were getting to the adequacy of the class itself and how the parents would know that.
Talking about, again, the representations, there are other declarations from other students in the class, including Danielle Diaz, who took first the TES class and then the Testmasters class, and said that she had done terribly in the TES class and then improved after taking the Testmasters class and thought the Testmasters class was superior. So there is testimony
if
that
we agreed with Judge Robertson on the speculative nature of the lost opportunities. What does that leave you?
Us with out-of-pocket damages.
Out-of-pocket damages.
It leaves us
and
with
what are those? How much are those?
The out-of-pocket damages are the difference in the value of the
and
court.
And what is that?
Well, that's
have you put on any evidence of that?
Well, in Espelet versus Berlitz by the D.C. Circuit, the court held that the jury is entitled to make that determination based on the evidence of what is put forward, what we testify to at trial.
Not a whole lot, though, here for the number of plaintiffs.
We would say it's no more than $1,300 per plaintiff.
Okay. And how many plaintiffs?
There are three plaintiffs. But they do bring the case on behalf of the general.
And then statutory damages, what would that be?
$1,500 per plaintiff, Your Honor. Okay. If there are no further questions, I think I've gone well over my time. I would appreciate an opportunity for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Jewell.
Good morning. May it please the court. Just to follow up, Kevin Jewell on behalf of Testmasters, just to follow up to begin with Judge Williams's questions about the deception or the alleged deception in this case. The truth of the matter is there has been no evidence presented at all that any statements made on our website were false or inaccurate. And even more to the point here, all of the plaintiffs gave their depositions and we asked them specifically about those issues, and none of them said that they saw or relied upon any of those statements whatsoever that the plaintiffs have alleged are inaccurate in their complaint. All the plaintiffs did was get a recommendation about an LSAT course.
What about the
from
phone
friends.
Call? What about the phone calls?
And they got the phone number off the website, and then they called our office and then registered for the class. And that was all there was to it. And
the affidavits claim that there were conversations that took place that the operator should have understood that they were looking for something different than what was
there. Was certainly no evidence presented of what the operators would have understood from the conversations that occurred. Everything that's been presented by the plaintiffs in their declarations is nothing but speculation on their part. that they think that someone was...
It shows a number of affidavits showing confusion on the part of the caller, right, thinking that they were buying one thing and...
Confusion on the part of the caller, but not any indication on our part that we should have been aware of that. And that's particularly so in the case of Kirthi Reddy, one of the named plaintiffs here, who called our office, signed up for an LSAT class when she was a returning student. She had taken our class from our company in Houston when she was in high school and took the SAT course. Why would we have any belief whatsoever that she was calling a company different from the one that she had called when she had previously taken our class? And she claimed a returning student discount when she signed up and enrolled for our LSAT course. There's simply no evidence presented here that there'd been any intent on my client's part to deceive anybody. And certainly under the standard that's required.
What do you do with those averments where they claim that someone calls in and say, I've heard about your course that was done in Colorado or elsewhere, or heard about the one you already done in D.C., and it's clear that it's not referring to
There's never been any evidence presented, and Mr. Israni, the president of the company, testified on this part, and that's in the record. There's been never been any evidence presented that anybody that the plaintiff spoke to had any idea or knowledge about what particular classes had occurred in what particular cities, because different people would answer the phones at different times. And they would just take the calls, and when someone said, I wanted to sign up for a class in X city, then they sign them up for the class or they refer them to somebody else. Now, in instances where someone calls and specifically references a competitor, like, you know, Princeton Review, or I'm trying to call somebody else, then we correct them and we refer them to people who are competitors. And there's a ton of people in the market who do this type of business. And that's clear from the evidence that we presented. And in fact, we have modified our student enrollment agreement to clarify for students that we are not Princeton Review or Kaplan or Robin Singh or any other course preparation companies, so that there is no confusion in that regard. So it's our position that there's simply no evidence of the issue of intent, and obviously Judge Robertson didn't reach that question in his opinion. But we did raise that in the summary judgment motion, as pointed out.
Why didn't the district court deal with the issue of out-of-pocket expenses? He was focusing, seemed entirely, on the lost business opportunities. Well, and throughout the complaint, throughout the briefing, There was also this argument raised about out-of-pocket expenses.
Right. Part of the issue to that, and this is kind of a long story, but part of the issue for that, I'll give you the short version. Part of the issue for that is that the plaintiff's strategy throughout the entire discovery process of this case was to focus on their claim for lost opportunity damages and the fact that they had been deprived of an opportunity to be admitted to better law schools and better paying jobs, and they never focused any discovery on this out-of-pocket theory.
It's in fact, it's in the complaint, though, right?
Really. I mean, in a general sense, they claim monetary damages, but that's it. In the complaint. But and as Your Honor pointed out, there was no evidence presented, certainly no expert testimony and no fact witness presented who was going to testify about what the difference in value was between the course they alleged they got and the course they were supposedly promised, which was not even a theory that they put in their petition. The idea that we were promised X, Y, and Z from the class but only got X and Y was not something that was articulated in their complaint at all and was never pursued or raised until they filed a response to our summary judgment motion. And it was at that time when they were attempting to, in my view, shift the focus of the case away from the case they had pleaded to a different theory of prosecution. One of the issues, of course, just briefly I'll comment on, Mr. Zavari made a comment about the discovery. He claims we were not forthcoming in the discovery. As Your Honor pointed out, if there were any iota of truth to those points, they would have raised a valid point of error in this court about discovery, some discovery order of a trial court somewhere, and they have done none of that here. But as the court is aware, the other side has peppered their briefing with attempts to malign us through the discovery process, and none of that has any bearing whatsoever on this appeal, and there is no support for any of those claims. With respect, and let me sort of follow up on this out-of-pocket issue, in addition to what I've already explained to the court, the plaintiffs can't rely upon this out-of-pocket issue because, and particularly to create standing, because their position here in having paid for the course, or actually two of them paid for the course, one of them didn't, their position is no different than the plaintiffs in the Williams case or the Hoyt case that we discussed in the briefing, where in Williams the plaintiffs had purchased the drug from which they suffered no ill effects, and in the Hoyt case the plaintiffs had purchased the chicken that was supposedly falsely advertised and they suffered no ill effects. The fact that they bought a product doesn't by itself grant them standing to sue, and the outcome here should be no different than it is in those cases, particularly where they haven't alleged or presented any proof whatsoever that there is any difference in value in what they received. And of course, as Kirthi Reddy exemplifies, she is the only witness who's involved in any of these matters who has taken both our class and the competitor's class, and she's made almost identical scores in the LSAT when she took it. So there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that's been presented that there's any difference whatsoever in the classes that are material. In addition to the matters I've discussed already, we think that in the event the court decides that they're standing here, that the summary judgment can be affirmed on the many alternate grounds that have been briefed and were presented to the trial court, and we ask the court to do so. If there are no further questions, I'll give back my time.
What do you understand to be the threshold under the CPPA for statutory damages? So that what must the plaintiff establish for that?
The plaintiffs have taken the position in this case, based upon this court's opinion in Shaw, that they get the benefit of standing because they've been injured due to a deprivation of their statutory rights alone under the Act. That theory does not help them here because there has, in fact, been no evidence presented of a deprivation, which is unlike what happened in Shaw. There was evidence of a deprivation of the Act, and there's not any evidence of that here.
Okay, what was the deprivation in Shaw?
Well, in Shaw, it was the pricing scheme of the hotel, and it was my understanding from reading the Shaw case that the pricing scheme in and of itself was violative of the Consumer Protection Act, and so when the plaintiffs in Shaw paid for the hotel.
The parallel theory here is that the misrepresentation, and assume arguendo there was a misrepresentation, that itself was the violation and therefore the injury.
You would have to, well, if there was a misrepresentation and therefore a violation of the Act, I might agree with that, but there has been no evidence presented here of the violation.
Then what you appear to be saying is that affirmance could not rest on damages only, it would have to reach misrepresentation. Because if misrepresentation is assumed, then both jurisdiction and statutory damages are present. Is that right? That seems to be what a combination of D.C. law and circuit law add up to.
And I guess I wouldn't disagree with that. I just think that that's a leap to say that there's an assumption on the merits here when you get to that issue of whether or not there's been injury or causation.
But if you win on absence of misrepresentation, you win flat out.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Does have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
With respect to the issue of the website, I would like to direct the court's attention to our reply brief, pages 7 through 9, in which we actually cite to declarations of other students testifying about how they felt the website was deceptive and why they believed that they were deceived by the website. With respect to the issue of intent raised by Mr. Jewell, the only thing that they have to refute our evidence of intent is a self-serving declaration of somebody who wasn't even involved in the phone calls. And the law is clear, again, that such declarations by somebody denying an intent is not sufficient to create a triable issue of fact. with respect to the question of why we didn't appeal the discovery orders, there were no discovery orders to appeal. There were no denials of any of our motions to compel. We had a Rule 56F motion. We had motions for discovery that were never ruled upon by the court.
Well, that wouldn't prevent you from citing that as a basis for reversal.
Well, again, Your Honor, the primary basis for reversal is the failure of the court to address the statutory damages and the out-of-pocket damages.
I understand, but your appeal brings up all the reasons that could have been invoked, that can be invoked for affirmance, right?
Yes, indeed, Your Honor.
Right. So, and since this is a procedural problem, in your view, that relates to those substantive issues, it was easily brought up.
It was, Your Honor, but we didn't, it was not an issue that was properly raised until the defendant raised it in their opposition brief, because the issue at that point premised was based solely on the question of damages. And the question of intent had never come up. It had never been decided. It had never been litigated before the district court. Thank you.
Thank you.